You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. And the issue of the day, and boy, are the right-wingers just totally bat guano crazy about it, is Iran. Jacob, if you could cue up clip number 12 here. This is a compilation of just a few recent press reports.
Iran's threat to the United States in the United States.
Tonight, defying the world. The Iranians claim a major advance in their nuclear program.
Iran is changing its game plan.
Further proof that Iran wants to join the club of nuclear nations.
All right, showdown with Iran.
Iran is warning that it may take preemptive action.
The evidence of a kind of shadow war now being waged by Iran around the world.
All of that from commondreams.org, and tip of the hat to the fine folks there who put it together. Paul Pillar is with us. He is the visiting professor and director of studies in the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University, WashingtonMonthly.com, where you can find his writings. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
Very, very happy to have you with us, Dr. Pillar. Can we live with a nuclear Iran?
Yes, we can. We've lived with nuclear weapons in the hands of more fearsome, even more nefarious regimes in the past. I mean, you know, the first one we dealt with was no less than Stalin's Soviet Union. And then we had Mao's China. And this is before the memory of most of your listeners, but China tested its first nuclear weapon back in 1964. This was during the Johnson administration. And there was so much concern back then that the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, tried to use some kind of domestic public diplomacy by reassuring people, don't get too scared about this, even though that Chinese regime is so awful. And we should recall that at the time, you know, Mao Zedong was saying things like, well, a nuclear war, you know, wouldn't be too bad. China would probably lose about a third of its population, could lose even half of its population, but we'd still come out ahead of capitalism.
Well, that was right around the time that China had a massive famine, wasn't it, and tens of millions of people died?
Well, this was toward the end of the Great Leap Forward, in which tens of millions of people died, and then in the subsequent several years, the first few years after the acquisition of the nuclear weapon, we had Mao's Cultural Revolution, which was one of the most chaotic and fanatical periods in Chinese history. And despite all that, deterrence was maintained. And indeed, a few years after that, Richard Nixon made rapprochement with Beijing the centerpiece of his global strategy. So we've been all through this sort of thing before. And there was, of course, the first Islamic bomb, as it was then called, when Pakistan got it.
Yep.
Now, none of these things are good as far as nuclear proliferation is concerned. It's always a blow to the non-proliferation order to have another regime get a nuclear weapon, but it is not anything like the cataclysm that it's been made out to be.
Yeah, and in fact, my recollection of back in the 60s was there was concern that, you know, if the Chinese are willing to go through a situation where many millions of their people starve, then they may be willing to bomb us to get food. I mean, there was, you know, all this hype around that. As I vaguely recall, I was 13 in 1964. But the question, I mean, this, we've had two, the former head of Mossad and the former head of Israeli intelligence, which is some apparently separate from Mossad, have both come out in the last week and said that a nuclear Iran does not represent an existential threat to Israel. You're saying it doesn't represent a threat to the United States. Are both of those statements accurate?
Yes, they are. In fact, we've had several. We've had a couple of different previous heads of Mossad, and that is the Civilian Intelligence Service, Israel's counterpart to the CIA, as well as, according to one report, the current head of the service, all explicitly denying that this would be, an Iranian nuke would be an existential threat to Israel. And it's easy to see why they would deny it, since even if Iran got the bomb, Israel would retain overwhelming military superiority at the nuclear level, where by most accounts Israel has at least 100, possibly 200, or even 300, you know, nuclear weapons,
right,
as well as conventional systems and delivery systems that are far beyond anything Iran would have.
Right, and we have over 10,000, and we've got 40, if my recollection is correct, more than 40 military bases within 100 miles of the border of Iran.
Well, that's right. And to the extent that Iran is interested in acquiring a nuclear weapon, and I have no reason to disbelieve the judgments of our senior intelligence officials, that they have not yet made such a decision but are only keeping their options open. But if they do decide to do that, their overwhelming motivation for doing it would be deterrence. All they have to do is listen to the, they could listen to that compendium of news clips that you just played a moment ago, and all the accompanying rhetoric about should we bomb them now versus bomb them later. And you can understand the authorities in Tehran have plenty of reason to want to have a deterrent, but so far they don't seem to have made that.
Which raises the question, if common sense, if diplomats, if the President of the United States, who said, you know, this rhetoric isn't helping, when Mitt Romney wrote his op-ed in the Washington Post last week saying that Iran was working on a bomb and was hustling as fast as they could, not his exact words, but words to that effect, which is what prompted the two Israeli intelligence officials to come out and say, oh, whoa, wait a minute. If all that is true, why is it that there is this steady drumbeat for war? This is a country with 73 million human beings in it. I mean, 73 million people. It's a fairly modern country. I don't get it. I don't. And the phrase existential threat to the existence of Israel, I have heard, you know, I heard at least twice on the Sunday talk shows this last weekend, and you can hear virtually every day, sometimes every hour on Fox News. Where is this coming from?
Well, most of it is coming from Israel, and it's perhaps hard for those of us who have grown up in other circumstances to totally duplicate the emotions and the mindset of people in Israel, and this does go beyond just the Netanyahu government, although that government is the one who's been exploiting the issue, of fear, of emotion, given history, given, of course, the outrageous anti-Israel rhetoric we hear from Ahmadinejad in Tehran. But all of that is very different from the question of what actually would be in Israel's interest, and it's far, far different from what would be in U.S. interest. When someone like Meir Dagan, the former head of Mossad, who said an Israeli military attack on Iran is the stupidest idea I've ever heard, says something like that, what he has in mind, I think quite accurately, is the concept that if Israel were to take such a step, it would simply push Israel farther down into the bottomless pit of regional isolation and perpetual warfare. They would never be at peace with their neighbors, and that kind of attack would do them no good.
And yet our media seems to love wars. They're very good for getting eyeballs to TV stations so that they can make ad dollars.
Well, of course.
Or am I being too cynical?
Well, no, you're not being too cynical. The other big factor in terms of why we're hearing all the war rhetoric this year, of course, is our election calendar.
Right.
And that plays off against the Israel dimension that I was just discussing.
Yeah, it was 4 years ago that John McCain was singing bomb, 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 bomb Iran to an audience of people.
That's right.
On the campaign trail.
Clearly, the Republican presidential candidates, with the sole exception of Ron Paul, see this as a wedge issue, see this as a device for trying to exploit sympathy with Israel in particular by seeing who can sound most bellicose on Iran.
Yeah, and they're doing a pretty good job of it.
They are.
Paul Pillar, WashingtonMonthly.com, the director of study, visiting professor and director of studies at the Security Studies Program at Georgetown University. Sir, thank you so much for the great work you're doing and for sharing your insights with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
It's much appreciated. We will be back. Tom Hartman here with you. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dog whistle politics coming up next. The latest game the Republicans and Sarah Palin are playing.
That old Beach Boys song, Bomberan.
Bomb, 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 bomberan. Bam,
because we can, right? This is mind-boggling. Our telephone number, by the way, 866-987-THOM. And here, this is an ad that the White House has put together, or the Obama campaign, not the White House, the President Obama's reelection campaign has put together, calling out Sarah Palin for something that she said on Fox News a few days ago. And it, all it is Sarah Palin in her own words. I mean, it starts out with some screen graphics that say, you know, Sarah Palin is added again, or words to that effect. And then it ends with screen graphics that say that she's calling for divisions by race and whatnot. And this isn't right for American politics. But here's what Sarah Palin had to say in her own words.
Barack Obama has never been, I think, seen in the conventional, traditional way of we who would describe a man of valor. And his profession as a community organizer, what went into his thinking was this philosophy of radicalism. He is bringing us back, Sean, to days that you can harken back to days before the Civil War. What Barack Obama seems to want to do is go back to before those days when we were in different classes based on income, based on a color of skin. Why are we allowing our country to move backwards?
Yeah. Why are we letting Barack Obama resegregate America? Now, why would a white Republican be on TV saying that the black guy in the White House wants to segregate America? Because this is the dog whistle politics that the Republican Party is using. And what they're saying, and what Sarah Palin was saying, was not that she thinks that Barack Obama wants to resegregate America with African Americans on the bottom like it was last time. No, in the Republican, this twisted Republican worldview, President Obama wants to resegregate Americans with white people on the bottom. You get it? This is the core message of the white supremacist groups. And if they tell you any different, they're lying. I mean, this is very straightforward. What do you do if you're a political party and your main agenda is simply to kowtow to the interests and protect the interests of the very rich and the very powerful, of the billionaires and the transnational corporations? That's your agenda as a political party. How are you ever going to get elected? Most voters are not billionaires or millionaires or transnational corporations. So how do you get elected? Well, what you have to do is you have to create a big tent. You have to bring a lot of people in who don't even really know that your agenda is about helping millionaires and billionaires. In fact, you kind of keep that on the QT. I mean, most people don't pay attention to what you're actually doing in Congress. They pay attention to what you say. And so what you say is words that will reach out to single-interest voters. You say words that will reach out to people who are afraid of gays or who hate gays. Homophobes. You use that kind of language. You use words that will call out to people who are obsessed with their phallic toys, their guns, and you try to scare them. Oh, he's going to take your guns away. He wants to label your ammunition. You reach out to men who think it's important to control women, and you talk about, you know, women as bimbos and whores, and you want to see their sex tapes. Prostitutes, you use that kind of language to degrade women and keep them in their place. Start a war about contraception. Hold hearings in Congress about the religious dimensions of religious freedom with regard to contraception, and don't allow any women to speak. And that's dog whistle politics for men who dislike women, and it's a surprising percentage of men, I'm sure. Some of the numbers are actually rather startling. You reach out to people who are poorly educated and think that college-educated people are the elite. Remember when Rick Santorum a few days ago talked about, Obama wants everybody to go to college. Yeah, it's a snobbish. Right. Dog whistle politics. You reach out to people who hate or fear African Americans. And in reaching out to those people, you say, here's an African-American in the White House. Don't forget that. Hey, did I mention he's black? Nixon came up with this as his southern strategy to get white racists to vote for him. Ronald Reagan, when he was nominated to be president of the United States by the Republican Party at the convention, the first speech he gave after that, his let me introduce myself to the nation speech, that the white racists in the South all can tell you about to this day. It's why they love Reagan so much. Was in Philadelphia, Mississippi. You ever heard of Philadelphia, Mississippi? This is a little town of 7,000 people. Odds are, unless you watched the movie Mississippi Burning or you are familiar with the story of Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, who were murdered, the three civil rights workers who were murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi in the 1960s, odds are you'd never heard of Philadelphia, Mississippi. But that's where Ronald Reagan gave his first speech. And his first speech, well, in fact, he said, I will quote from Reagan's first speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi. He said, I believe in states' rights. I believe we have disturbed the balance, distorted the balance of our government today by giving powers that were never intended to be given in the Constitution to that federal establishment. He's talking about integration. He's talking about civil rights. He's talking about the Voting Rights Act. He promised that he would, quote, restore to states and local governments the power that properly belongs to them. In other words, the power to say, before you vote, you got to take this literacy test. Before you vote, you've got to have ID. Before you vote, you've got to, jump through these hoops. This is talking in code, just like when Sarah Palin says that Obama wants to separate people by skin color. Her phrase, not mine. You know, as the president rightly points out, there's really no place for this. And yet, more a plurality in some estimates of over 50%, most of them are in the high 40s, of Republican primary voters in the states of Alabama and Mississippi, where tonight is a primary. A plurality of the voters in those states think that President Obama is a Muslim. Why would they think that? Because Fox has been beating that drum for years. He's the other.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And when you make somebody the other, then it's easy to hate them, right? It's somebody, something to, oh, he's a Muslim. He's an African American.
Everywhere's war. Killing a brother.
War.
Destroying the country.
War.
For nothing.
War.
For nothing.
You know, I find this, welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. I find this absolutely amazing that the majority of Republican or plurality of Republican voters in Alabama and Mississippi, where the vote is being held tonight for the Republican primary, believe that President Obama is a Muslim. Only 16%. Now, this is a guy who has proclaimed his Christianity, written books about his Christianity, goes to church every Sunday, unlike Ronald Reagan, who never went to church. Or rarely, ceremonially went to church. That was it. This is a guy who actually does it. And yet, only 16% of Republicans in the Deep South know that he's a Christian. It's incredible. And that, and it's not like I'm, you know, the subtext to that is, oh, well, if somebody's a Muslim, there must be something wrong. No. Of course not. Unless you're a Republican. If you're a Republican, yeah, labeling somebody as a Muslim is a big deal because Republicans, you know, they're having a hard enough time thinking about voting for a Mormon or a Muslim. But mostly it's like, hey, have you noticed he's different? His dad's from Africa. Ba-ba-ba. So. Anyhow, back. Let's pick up a few calls here. Mike in Wytheville, Virginia, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Mike, what's up?
All right, Tom. You know, I'm a conservative now, but I need to. I just need maybe you can explain this to me on the gas prices during George Bush's presidency when the gas prices went up. The left was screaming that it was Bush's fault. He's in bed with the oil companies. It's all his fault.
Well, I don't know now, which left you're talking about, Mike, because I was on the air when George Bush was president and those prices were going up, and I was screaming about speculation on Wall Street because that's where it was happening. Goldman Sachs had been deregulated back in the early years of the Bush administration. They had actually gotten the permission during the Clinton administration, I believe, but it might have been before that. In fact, I'll bet it was. In any case, they got permission. It used to be that the Commodity Futures Trading Commission said that if you want to, that the total amount of trades in any commodity couldn't exceed 20% by people who were not true intra-parties. In other words, people who produce pork bellies, people who consume pork bellies, you know, who turn them into sausage or whatever. People who make oil, people who burn oil. The airlines and the oil companies. It used to be there was an absolute limit. 80% of all the commodity future trading had to be among those groups, and only 20% could be people who just kind of wanted to ride the coattails of it. And Goldman Sachs came in and said, would you make an exception for us? And they said, sure. And, you know, you could take it up to like 37%, as I recall, something like that. They started pushing it beyond that, and the CFCC said, oh, well, that's okay. You just do whatever you want. And then bank after bank, and a total of 20-some-odd banks came forward and got exemptions. This was all by the mid-2000s. And as a result, what we saw was in 2008, you saw over 70% of the counterparties in oil futures contracts were banks, not oil companies and not airlines. And I was pointing that out, and a lot of people on the left, to quote you, were pointing that out. Frankly, a lot of people on the right were pointing that out. President Bush was pointing that out, trying to point out that it wasn't his fault, it was the banksters doing it. And it's the banksters doing it again now. When oil prices were at a buck and a half, almost a little less than $2 a gallon when President Obama was elected, the banks had basically gotten out of the oil business. They were about 30% of the total counterparty trades. Now they're up to 70%. They're doing it again. The other thing that's happening is that the oil companies are exporting gasoline like there's no tomorrow. Go back and look at USA Today, December 31st of last year. The last day of last year, USA Today had a major story on how the product, the number one manufactured product in the United States, is not that we export. It's not computers. It's not blue jeans. It's not cars. It's gasoline. We are exporting more gasoline than any other product that we manufacture, refining being considered a manufacturing process. And why would the gas companies be exporting so much gasoline? Well, because it keeps gas prices up inside the United States. So, you know, it's like they're keeping the supply down of gas and they're regulating the supply of oil by holding the futures. And they're jacking these prices up. And you'll recall a month ago when President Obama said he was not going to go along in the Keystone Pipeline, the head of the American Petroleum Institute came out and said he's going to pay a political price. And the next week, oil prices and gas prices started to rise precipitously. This is a political hit job. And frankly, I think in 2008, I'm not sure that the oil companies were going after George W. Bush. I don't think that that was a political hit job. I think they were just out of control. That was the year. See, 2007 is when the housing crash actually happened. Just like 1927 is when the big housing bubble burst in the United States. There's a huge housing bubble in Florida. Land prices had gone up over 1,000% in most of Florida between 1922 and 1927. Just like we saw here in the United States in the 6 years or so leading up to 2008. And as a consequence of that, when that housing bubble burst in 27, it made the stock market crash of 29 inevitable. And when I saw the housing bubble burst in the United States in 2007 on this radio show, I said, we've got a big crash coming. Look out, guys. Get your money out of the stock market. And there's no shortage of people who call into this program on a regular basis and thank me for it. And I took, you know, all of our money out of the stock market. I said, put your money in cash, put it in treasuries, do something like that. So I think that the banks were just, they saw this crash coming. They knew it was coming. They knew everything was out of control. And they were just trying to churn as hard as they could and make as much money as they could, as fast as they could. And they didn't care who was in office at that time, you know, whether it hurt. And George W. Bush wasn't running for reelection, so it wasn't like it was going to hurt him. So anyhow, pardon my rant. Oh, the caller dropped off. Okay. I did not dump that caller. Apparently, he didn't know those facts. Bill in Missoula, Montana, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Well, I was listening to you and about voting, and I grew up in Oklahoma, but I live in Montana now, and I was listening to you about having ID for voters, which they require in Montana, which to me just makes common sense. I don't think it's a big plot to keep people from voting. I think.
How does it make common sense to say to people who are too poor to afford a car that they have to go out and get a driver's license if they want to vote?
You can get a Montana ID for nothing and vote.
If you don't have a car, can you get to the place where you get them?
Yes. Well, of course. Yeah, they're not all stuck at home.
Why? You know, what are you going to do about somebody who's 80 years old and is stuck at home?
Well, if they're stuck at home, they probably won't go vote.
It's called an absentee ballot. We have that now.
I understand, but that's the reason I really
want to. So you don't want old people, you don't want poor people, and you don't want okay, I get it.
Of course, I want everyone to vote.
Let's drop the barriers to voting.
I would like to know who they are.
Bill, can you tell me the name of one person who has committed voter fraud in the last 25 years? I'll send you a copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, a hardcover copy of it. We're going to give away today to our best. I'm not sure what it is. Paul's going to let me know here. I'll send you that book. Say that again? Yeah, other than Ann Coulter, who apparently committed voter fraud by registering at her agent's home because she didn't want her own home in the public records.
Are you telling me no one has committed voter fraud in the last 25 years?
I'm telling you that there are about 15 people in the last 25 years who have been prosecuted and convicted of it, and they have all been sufficiently obscure that neither one of us knows their names because none of them did it for political purposes. In almost every case, it was people who were ex-felons, and they didn't realize that in the state they lived, an ex-felon couldn't vote. There is no problem with voting fraud.
While I was on hold, I was listening to your message about oil companies, and that's what you were talking about. And that's what I'd really like to talk to you
okay,
about.
Okay, go for
that's
it.
That's what I told.
Okay, I just make one last point. You're more likely, lightning kills more people in the United States every year than commit voting fraud in a decade. This is a non-issue. But already they've knocked 5 million people off the ballots in state after state. And here's, if I can just finish this up, and I will give you the time to answer, Bill. But here's Paul Weyrich. This is Ronald Reagan's principal campaign strategist in 1980, speaking to a group of Republicans in a church.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
See, Republicans know that. So anyhow, you want to talk about oil, Bill. It's all yours.
Oil prices. I worked for an oil company in marketing for 31 and a half years. Mm-hmm. I did retail for them. I did hedging with airlines for them and rail companies and people like that. And I'm now retired, but I have my own oil business in a park. I'm a concessioner, and I pay 3.5% of my gross revenue, so I don't want the prices to go up.
Right.
But I keep watching, and for all but two of about the last 6 or 7 years, in January or February, the news media starts talking about gas prices are going to be $5.
Right.
Gas price. You can't turn on the radio today or the television on any news channel without hearing about how high gas is going to be.
Right.
And any pricing manager with an IQ above 10 is going to make sure that comes true if you guys keep giving them all that free advertising.
Yeah. Okay. So you think that the price of oil is going up, but the price of gas is going up because people in the media are saying it's going to go up. Go ahead.
Is emotion caused by that? I think that causes more speculation.
I think it has more to do with the fact that, like in 2008, the Koch brothers actually leased super tankers to fill them with gasoline and park them off the coast to keep it off the marketplace. Now they're exporting this stuff to keep it off the marketplace. I think that's what's driving it up, Bill. But thank you for your call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, a crazy alert. Do the squirrels in your yard drink from a straw? Oh, it's our crazy alert. Bushy-tailed and busy in the backyard. We all know how hard squirrels will work to find food in our backyard, but one little guy went the extra mile. A gray squirrel in Hampshire, England, spent two tireless hours learning how to sip a peanut smoothie out of a glass. At first, the curious creature just sniffed around the glass, trying to find a way to eat the peanutty pleasure. After some time, he grabbed the straw in the glass with his claws, brought the straw to his mouth, and began drinking the smoothie just like any human would do. Sipping squirrel even managed to start drinking straight out of the glass. I guess the straw just wasn't doing the trick. Seeing this one squirrel's affection for them, maybe peanut smoothies will become the latest garden-eating deterrent. I wonder if I could teach Higgins how to drink from a straw. I don't think he'd drink peanut butter smoothies, though. He'd prefer squirrel smoothies. Yeah, there we go. Anyhow, Jeff in Colorado Springs, Colorado, watching us on Free Speech TV, is on the line. And Jeff, you were wondering, how did the Supreme Court get the power to strike down laws?
Exactly.
Okay. The Supreme Court, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that the Supreme Court has the power to have what's called judicial review or judicial supremacy, these twin doctrines, that they can...
That's my question.
Pardon?
How did they get away with it?
Okay, here's how they got away with it. In 1803, James Madison was let's go back to the election of 1800. In the election of 1800, Jefferson beat Adams, and Adams did everything he could to harm Jefferson on his way out. They were absolute political enemies. John Adams was our first hardcore right-wing president. Thomas Jefferson was our first hardcore progressive president. George Washington had been kind of in between, and Adams was president number two, Jefferson president number three. So Adams, trying to set the stage for Jefferson, trying to screw him up, created all these new judicial offices, because the executive branch could create judicial offices, and Congress, Adams had Congress in his pocket at that time. He lost Congress, by the way, in the election of 1800 as well. But he had them, and so he created all these new judgeships and sheriffdoms, and these offices into which he could appoint his buddies, the High Federalists, the hardcore right wingers, the Republican Party of their day, the Tea Partiers of their day.
The high sheriffs.
That's right. And one of them was a fellow by the name of James Marbury. And the Constitution says that if you are appointed to a position if the executive branch appoints you to a position, some of them have to be confirmed by the Senate, others don't. But if you're appointed, then you're appointed, and that's just the law. Congress, in the meantime, in 1899, as I recall, it might have been 1798, right around that time, just before the end of the Adams presidency, had passed a law saying that if you got one of these judge positions or sheriff positions, that it was only legal when the papers were handed to you, when you actually were served, the equivalent of service, when the sheriff comes out and says you're being served, you've got to show up in court, that kind of thing. And so when Jefferson came into office, there were these what are called midnight appointments. John Adams had appointed 20, 30, 40, I forget the number. It was a whole bunch of people. I mean, back in those days, that was a lot of new judges and new sheriffs and things like that. To stack the courts and stack the criminal justice system with his people. And most of them, he had his own Secretary of State deliver the papers. So those people were legally members of the judiciary or of the law enforcement branch of the executive branch. But there was about a half a dozen or so that he missed, that they couldn't find the people or they didn't get to them in time. And one of them was this guy named Marbury, and I think his name was James. And James Madison was the Secretary of State. And so it was the Secretary of State's job to deliver the papers. And James Madison, when they came into office in 1801, in March of 1801, Jefferson was sworn in. James Madison, under the instructions of Thomas Jefferson, the president, did not deliver those papers to Marbury and said, sorry, you don't get the job. You didn't. Now, according to this law Congress passed. So Marbury sued Madison in court, took it to court, and said to the Supreme Court that he should have the judgeship or whatever it was, sheriffdom or whatever. And it's been a lot of years since I read the story. And he should have that and the Supreme Court ruled, John Marshall ruled on this thing and said, no, the Constitution of the United States does not say that Marbury has to have the papers delivered to him. Therefore, the law that Congress passed was unconstitutional, and I, John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, am striking down this law passed by Congress. Now, Jefferson was stuck, because on the one hand, he had won the case, right? Marbury got screwed, and Madison and Jefferson won. On the other hand, Jefferson said, wait a minute, the Supreme Court is going to determine what our laws are? And in fact, what he said, and I can quote a good chunk of this from memory, I've read it so many times, he said, if this ruling stands, then indeed has the Constitution of the United States become a felo de se, which is Latin for a suicide pact. He said, for by this doctrine, the one branch of government, and an unelected one at that, now has final say over the laws of America. Thus, the Constitution has become a thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary to mold it in any form they please. And he was right. And he tried to push back against this, but Marshall wouldn't do it. But on the other hand, Jefferson's blowback was so loud, and the newspapers all across America were so horrified that the Supreme Court had taken this power after. You go back and read the Federalist Papers 79 and 80. Alexander Hamilton wrote these in 1787 when they were debating the Constitution. And everybody was worried about a too powerful judiciary not being elected. And Hamilton writes in Federalist number 80, I'm pretty sure it is, it might be 79. He says the Supreme Court is the least powerful. powerful, the least likely to create mischief of all the branches of government because they have no enforcement mechanism. They can proclaim things all day long, but they don't have an army. They don't have police forces. Those are the sole province of, you know, Congress has the Congressional Police Force, which can't do much outside of Washington, D.C., and the president runs the army. So he said, don't worry, be happy. And nowhere does it say that the Supreme Court has the power to strike down laws. But Jefferson made a big sturm und drang, but the Supreme Court didn't back down. But John Marshall sat in that office for, as I recall, 35 years as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, one of the longest serving Chief Justices in history. And only one more time did John Marshall ever declare, and this was after Jefferson was no longer president, long after Jefferson was no longer president, declare a law unconstitutional. It happened, this kind of thing happened once every 10 years. It was very, very rare, this doctrine. But it was the Marbury versus Madison 1803 case that established the doctrine of judicial review, and the second one that Marshall did established judicial supremacy, that the Supreme Court's rules were more important than Congress's. And it is unconstitutional. And this is something that I agree with Newt Gingrich and Phyllis Schlafly about, of all things. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Up next, a rumble. Is voter ID the same thing as voter suppression?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You have to feel a little empathy, I suppose, for Matt Romney. You know, Mitt Romney's son, one of his sons. I mean, you know, this is a guy, Mitt Romney, you know, if one of his kids wants to start a business, he says, here's $10 million, start the business. I'm not making this up. Here's $10 million, start the business. Anyhow, Matt was campaigning for Mitt in Hawaii, and he goes on TV, and somebody asks him a question about Obama, and he says, I'm not here to talk about President Obama. I think he's great. I'm here to talk about my dad and his vision for him. Yeah, right. This is his making up for having made a birther joke in New Hampshire. But an election is coming, and people are trying to get ready, as Grover Norquist, as Paul Weyrich pointed out back in 1980 when he was running Ronald Reagan's mail-order operation of Ronald Reagan's campaign and was credited with helping Reagan win the presidency, and then he was later credited with helping George Herbert Walker Bush win the presidency, and then in 2000, Paul Weyrich was credited with helping George W. Bush win the presidency, one of the most senior Republican strategists in the country, as he said to a group of Republicans in a church in 1980.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Right. Drive down that voting populace. And thus, the Koch brothers funded American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is pumping out these laws that states all over the country are passing, saying, oh, you got to have all kinds, 16 different kinds of ID, or maybe just one, to vote. Hans von Spakovsky is with us. He is with the Heritage Foundation, former commissioner of the Federal Election Commission, senior legal fellow with the Heritage Foundation. Hans, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. Now, I understand that you're a big fan of voter ID.
I think it's a common sense reform, and you know the majority of American people agree with that.
I think you're right. I don't think it's common sense, but I think that the majority of American people agree with it. I'm wondering if voter fraud is such a problem, can you please name for me one person who has gone to jail or even been arrested for fraudulently voting for political purposes?
I don't know about political purposes, but I can name you all kinds of prosecutions of people who have been convicted of voter fraud. And
In almost all those cases, though, as a former election, as the former commissioner of the FEC, you know that those were almost all people who were felons trying to vote in states where felons are not allowed to vote and they didn't realize it.
No, that is incorrect. The Justice Department, for example, the largest voter fraud prosecution case it ever conducted was in Chicago in the mid-1980s. They convicted over 60 individuals of voter fraud, and it included everything from voting in the names of people who were dead, casting fraudulent absentee ballots, stuffing ballot boxes in
right.
polling places. There
okay.
are a lot
so
of convictions.
So the
like
biggest
that.
The biggest case in the American history was 60 people.
Well, if you don't think that's important, I can tell you that the federal grand jury that investigated that case
right.
and the U.S. attorney estimated that in that election, 100,000 fraudulent ballots had been cast
but they
in
had,
the election.
They were able to account for 60. And you know, I totally agree with you that if a politician is paying people to vote for him, if you have, you know, and some cities are famous for their political machines and there have been problems in the past. But if a politician is paying you to vote for him, there should be a prosecution. I mean, you know, Blagojevich is in jail right now for a variation on this, but although it didn't have to do specifically with voting, it had to do with selling a Senate seat. But I am astounded that a reasonable and rational person like yourself would advocate for laws that have already knocked 5 million Americans off the voting rolls because older people who are housebound can't get out to get ID, and now they can't even cast an absentee ballot. People who live in urban areas and who can't afford a car also can't afford to get out to the DMV, can't afford to take a day off work and stand in line all day, can't afford the deposit of the driver's license.
That $5 million figure, I mean, 5 million person figure is a number, an estimate made up by the Brennan Center. It is wrong. And if you
what do you think
know,
it is then?
Look at the experience of Georgia and Indiana. They've had their photo ID laws in place now for over 6 years. There has been no downturn in the turnout of voters there. In fact, the turnout
of
African Americans.
But those laws are not as draconian as the laws that were just passed in Ohio and Wisconsin.
That is incorrect. The Supreme Court said that Indiana's photo ID law, which it upheld, was the strictest photo ID law in the country. These other laws are similar to those.
I think the Justice Department would tell you the Texas law was the strictest in the country. They just challenged it in court, federal court.
I know, and Texas has already sued them, and I'd be happy to put a bet on you that by the time it gets to the U.S. Supreme Court, Texas will win.
Well, given the makeup of the Supreme Court right now, I wouldn't take that bet. But again, 60 people, the biggest prosecution in American history, and you say the 5 million people being knocked off the rolls by this is an incorrect number. I'm wondering what you think the correct number is. Is it 500,000?
No, the correct number is none. The ACLU and the NAACP sued both Georgia and Indiana in federal court. And one of the reasons both cases were thrown out by the federal judges, the judges specifically said in their opinions that neither organization had been able to produce a single individual, a single witness who would be unable to vote because of the photo ID law. You can read that. That's
sure.
The federal court decision saying that.
Okay. Here, this is clip number one, Jacob. This is Tim Thompson. He was he's an American veteran, an old guy, and he showed up to vote in the primary a couple days ago, and they said, sorry, you can't vote. You don't have the right ID. Here he is.
What we should do is vote those people out of office that put this law in effect, because they don't have our rights in the best interest. They don't have the American people's rights in the best interest. If they want to put a condition on our rights, that's not justice.
Hans, as you know, more people are killed by lightning strikes in the United States than are in a single year than are accused of voting fraud in a decade. This is a problem. This is a solution. You guys are offering a solution to a non-problem. Why not focus on things like the fact that we have 50 million uninsured people in this country, or that, you know, one in five children in America experiences actual hunger in the course of a year? I mean, why not look at some real problems in America instead of saying, oh, we've got to stop people from voting?
This won't stop people from voting, and I doubt that the 46 voters in Troy,
stop
New York,
Tim Thompson from voting.
No, the Troy, New York right now has a voter fraud prosecution ongoing. They've already had 46 voters come in to testify that ballots were cast in their names when they didn't vote. I think they probably believe that making sure we have a secure
system. Then let's
system,
prosecute some people. You already have laws against this.
Without voter ID, it is extremely difficult to detect the kinds of voter fraud that it can prevent.
Well, you know, people rob a liquor store. They don't show their ID. Police catch them.
Look, you have to, if you apply for food stamps, if you go to into a drug store to get a prescription filled, there's a million things you have to show photo ID for.
I have never had a pharmacist ask me for ID.
Well, I have, and I've had that.
You must be getting narcotics.
At a doctor. Look.
I've never had a doctor ask me for ID either.
We can argue about this, but you can look at the turnout figures in the states that have had photo ID law in place for years. And none of the predictions that you're making, none of the predictions being made by the Brennan Center have borne fruit. All of those states, people have gotten out to vote. Their turnout
then
has
why do you care so much
increased.
About this? Why is it that Republicans for 30 years have been pounding this drum of we've got to make it harder for people to vote?
It doesn't make it harder for people to vote. What it does is ensure that we have secure and
tell
fair
that to Tim
election.
Thompson, an American vet who didn't have the right ID. Tell
why
that to
didn't
to,
he? Why didn't he go and get the free photo ID that's offered by every single state that has passed one of these laws?
Maybe he didn't have the time or the means. And why should anybody have to do that? Why in this country should people have to jump through hoops to vote?
Well, we're one of the only Western democracies that doesn't require.
You're using
this,
the exact
think,
same language
think,
that they were using in the Jim Crow South to justify poll taxes and literacy tests.
With Jim Crow whatsoever.
The literacy test. Google literacy test.
That is a historically preposterous.
Google literacy test
comparison.
And look at all the quotes from all the people saying this is necessary to protect the integrity of our elections.
This has nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Okay, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Hans von Spakovsky, you can read all about it at heritage.org. Hans, thanks for coming on the show and talking
sure
about it.
Sure thing, Tom. Bye-bye.
If they can count 424 billion for war, why can't they count our votes? And if they can count thousands of bombs and still be buying more, why can't they count our votes? We're not done. We're not done.
Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jeff in Spring Grove, Illinois, listening on WCPT, Chicago's Progressive Talk. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to call in and let you know, them not notifying voters that they changed voting districts is another way that they're trying to cut back on voter turnout, because up here in McHenry County, Illinois, the county clerk will not notify voters that their districts have been changed. We had two districts changed, Congressional District 8 that Joe Walsh was part of, and the 63rd District that Jack Franks was part of got changed. I got personally, my whole township got changed into the 64th District, which there's no incumbent because Mike Tryon district got changed, but they're not notifying anybody.
Amazing.
They don't want anybody to know so that they don't, you know, when people show up to vote, they're going to get so frustrated trying to vote in their district that they're just going to walk away.
Yeah, and this goes back to Paul Weyrich's statement that quite candidly, our leverage in the elections goes up as the voter populace goes down. And, you know, whether this is part of some massive Republican conspiracy or not, Jeff, I frankly don't know, or whether it's simply that, you know, the recession has left state and local governments just, you know, decimated. Tax collections are so bad they don't have the money to send out a mailing to let you know. I frankly just don't know, but it's still not a good thing. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the heads up on that. Don in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Don, thanks for listening to 1280 AM. What's up?
Hey, thank you for being on live now. Really
sure.
Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
My contention is this: every once in a while, the corporate media lets something happen. That you
Jack, I can't. You sound really muffled, like you're talking into your hand. Is there some way that
can you hear me better now?
No. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me better now?
No, Jack. I'm going to have to ask you to call back when you've got a better phone line. I'm sorry. It's impossible to understand what you're saying. Corey in Las Vegas, Nevada, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Corey, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I've got two things real quick on that price of oil you were talking about earlier. Why isn't the price of oil or the price of gasoline much higher than it is now? When I was living over in California in the 90s, sweet crude was going for $1 or $18.80, $19 a barrel.
Right.
And gas was 99 cents a gallon.
Right.
Now we're at 5 or 6 times that, but gas is not $5 and $6 a gallon yet.
Right.
What's the hiccup? Why isn't there a direct connection between the price of oil and the price of gas?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I would guess that, you know, the refiners have gotten more efficient over time, and perhaps there have been, you know, the refineries, I know the refineries in the United States have gotten so large that they're producing such a surplus that the number one export of this nation is refined gasoline. And
right, but you would think the price would be, you know, commensurate with the cost of oil and the refining costs and everything, that it would go up exponentially.
Well, you're assuming that back in the 90s when you had that differential, that that was a benchmark that, that in and of itself was reflective of a genuine relationship between the two, and that might not have been. It may be that now it, now it's more. I frankly don't know. I'm not an expert on these things. What I do know is that the banks are holding over 70% of the long contracts on oil right now, and that we are exporting gasoline. And those two things, plus all the Republicans screaming about Iran and having war in Iran, those three things are driving up the cost of gasoline. So,
I firmly believe if you don't plan on taking delivery, you shouldn't even be able to get involved with it.
I agree.
I mean,
I agree.
That's just common sense.
If you're not a counterparty to a trade, you have no business being in the trade. I'm totally with you. Corey, thanks a lot for the call. Douglas in Mesa, Arizona, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Douglas, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
I just got a couple of questions. The first one is...
please pick one, because I got a whole bunch of other callers here.
Okay, is the right to vote a inalienable right or a constitutional right? And is it just for anybody who happens to be in the country or for citizens?
It is for citizens, and to the best of my knowledge, the right to vote is not guaranteed in the Constitution, although equal protection of the laws is. I may get corrected on this, but I'm sure the chat room will find this out. But I believe that the right to vote is not protected under the Constitution, and that's how we had, you know, all these poll taxes and other things. Now, on the other hand, a lot of those got struck down by the Supreme Court as being unconstitutional. So maybe the right – I'll have to look into that, okay, Douglas? I'm
okay.
Sorry. I every now and then I get stumped, and let me do some digging. Ken in Crosby, Mississippi, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Ken, what's on your mind?
First and foremost, I'm an independent. I stopped taking my red and blue pills
okay.
for the Democrat and Republican Party 10 years ago. Yeah. The
you and Bernie Sanders.
I make is people think these representatives and senators are, you know, hate each other all the time on TV. It is much like Capitol Hill is much like the WWE. After the show on TV, they go out, wine and dine, you know, go and work out together, and everything else.
You know, up until the last 8 years, Ken, that was true. And the last 8 years, that has changed. And by and large, you're finding Republicans and Democrats are not hanging out with each other socially like they did back when Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to hang out and talk about legislation and get things done.
I think our biggest problem we got here in America is no term limits. They should be.
So you want to turn our government over to the lobbyists?
No, term limits.
Right, but if you put in term limits, then what happens is you've always got a whole bunch of newbies coming in. And what is the permanent institution in Washington, D.C. that will tell them how the rules work and where to go and how things work? It's the lobbyists. When you have term limits, what you do is you radically enhance the power of lobbyists. And that's why I think term limits is a bad idea. We do have term limits, I would add, Ken, in the United States. We call them elections. And we just need people to be more involved in those in that process. Thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. And, did you know that the Republicans are now trying to turn Social Security over to Goldman Sachs? I'll tell you about that after a break.
Well, you know those times when you feel like there's a sign there on your back. Says, I don't mind if you kick me. Seems like everybody has. Things go from bad to worse. You think they can't get worse than that, and then they do. You step off the straight and narrow and you don't know where you are. Use the needle of your compass to sew up your broken heart. Ask directions from a genie in a bottle of Jim Beam and she lies to you.
Oh, welcome back. Talk Media for the sane among us. For the rest of us, Tom Harmon here with you. My first job in radio is a country western DJ. I ended up then doing rock and roll and then progressive rock and then doing news for 7 years. And then I was a program director for a year. But my first – and I thought I hated country western music. I still love it. And Matt in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
Long-time listener. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
That's hilarious. You were a country DJ.
Yeah. Long ago and far away.
I was wondering, what divides us intellectually from Mississippi and Alabama, from the rest of the country? Why are those states deemed as being like the stupid states?
I think that a lot of it has to do with the history of labor. And if you go back, and there's some very thoughtful analysis of this that's been done over the years, and I'm sorry, I, off the top of my head, don't recall the titles or authors of any of the books that I've read on it. It's been probably 15 years or more since I've studied the issue. But after during the industrialization of the United States in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, when the Wagner Act was passed in 1935, and union shops started, and the South started unionizing just like the North did. And although most of the industrial activity was still in the North, the South was still largely agricultural, but there was a lot of textile work going on in the South, a lot of clothing being made, and people were forming unions. And so in 1947, in the election of 46, the Republicans took both the House and Senate for the first time since 1932, since the crash of 29. And they only held it for 2 years, and they lost the House for over 30 years. They didn't get it back until the year Newt, swept the House in 84, 86. Almost 40 years. So during that 2 years, they did a lot of damage. Harry Truman proposed a bill that would give everybody in America free health care. It was a Medicare Part E, basically. They shot that down. And then they passed a bill called the Taft-Hartley Act, which said that individual states could opt out of the provisions of the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, and if the majority of people in the workplace vote for a union, that's fine. They can have a union, but everybody doesn't have to participate in that union. And which basically makes it really easy for employers to bust unions and radically reduces the benefits both to the union and the union employees of having a union. And the southern states were the first to jump on this bandwagon. They all became right-to-work-for-less states very, very quickly. And so since the 40s, they've had lower wages. The average right-to-work-for-less state, people make $5,000 a year less than they do in a right-to-work-for state, in a free bargaining state. They also are twice as likely to die on the job. So, it's because you've got no union, with your back. And so now we're, three generations on from that? I mean, the 40s, arguably you've got the third generation coming up. People don't even remember it. But I would say that that's probably the largest single reason, because there was less revenue, there was less money, there was less money for schools, there was less money for education. People were stuck in cyclical poverty. And, it's just a genuine tragedy. But Matt, thanks a lot for calling. Thanks for listening to AM 760. I appreciate it. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. Nice to talk to you live.
Thank you. Yeah, it's nice to be here live. What's up?
Yeah, a few callers back was talking about he couldn't understand the price of gasoline and the price of a barrel of oil.
Mm-hmm.
If you pay attention to the price of a barrel of oil every day and pay attention to the price, the wholesale price of gasoline, and then watch what the gasoline stations do, as soon as the price of a barrel of oil goes up, the price of gasoline shoots up. But when it goes down, it takes about 4 or 5 days for it to start coming down to where it should be.
Right.
When 2008, when we were at $4.15 a gallon, the price of a barrel of oil was $140 a barrel.
Yeah.
We're at about $106, $108, I think.
Yeah. This is why ExxonMobil is the most profitable corporation in the history of the planet. Why, when Lee Raymond retired as the CEO of ExxonMobil, he got a $400 million bonus, a golden parachute for retiring. This is why ExxonMobil pays no income taxes. It's why, it's like these guys are like, the kings of the earth. And, when the price goes up of oil, the price of gasoline immediately goes up. When the price of oil goes down, the price of gasoline kind of stays up where it was for a while, and they make some money on the spread, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. I appreciate it. Janie, in Round Rock, Texas, watching us on Free Speech TV. Janie, what's up?
Hi, good afternoon. I was just thinking that the way the Republicans and especially Ron Paul are screaming so much about free market, their hands are so tied. I think that we are actually living under the free market and that they are so collusive. They've got all the laws they need to back them up.
Yep.
Like you just said, some of them have become the richest in the history of the planet.
Yep.
And they're exploiting us and they're actually abusive. So I just thought that we ought to be saying that we are living under the free market with free reign. And it is abusive, and that's the result.
Yep. The technical term is the old French laissez-faire, which I think means hands off or no rules or something to that effect. And, Janie, you nailed it spot on. Thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. And I can tell you, the chat room, always, I can always rely on the chat room. This is awesome. Apropos of our voting debate, my debate with Hans von Spaskowski, in Ohio, this Steve A.T. Posts this from the blackamericaweb.com. In Ohio, this is actually from the NAACP, I believe. In Ohio, for example, a statewide survey of votes cast in 2002 and 2004 found that out of 9 million voters, there were 4 instances of voting fraud, according to the NAACP report. In fact, and this is quoting from the NAACP, in fact, there were more reported UFO sightings than reports of impersonation at the polls, with a grand total of 9 suspected fraudulent votes that could have been prevented by restrictive photo IDs since 2000, a period in which over 400 million votes were cast in general elections, with in-person electoral fraud occurring at the rate of 0.000002%, an individual is more likely to be struck by lightning than to impersonate another voter in the polls. And with regard to the right to vote, there is no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. I was right. I was pretty sure that that was the case, and then I started thinking, but wait a minute, the 16th Amendment and the 13th Amendment, I believe, and the 20th Amendment, or the 19th, one of them gave African Americans the right to vote, the other gave women the right to vote, and it prohibited based on race. It's the 15th, that was African Americans. And then the 19th and 26th Amendments, gender and age. So the 19th Amendment, passed in 1920, it must be. That's where I get my 20 in there, gave women the right to vote. And then the 26th Amendment, which was passed in the 70s, as I recall, said that you could vote if you're 18. But none of them, nowhere in the Constitution does it say that you have a right to vote. Because if it did, these Republicans wouldn't be able to do this. I mean, it's pretty straightforward stuff. Dave in Murphy's, California. Hey, Dave, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for everything you and your crew do. I want to answer your question of who's created voter fraud. It seems to me that it's John Roberts' Supreme Court and the corporate personhood of Diebold.
Yeah, you could argue that because we have no idea who actually voted and how, because most of our votes now are counted by electronic machines that the companies, the corporations, claim proprietary software. They will not let us see what's going on inside, and they don't let us see an unbroken chain of votes that nobody really knows who voted. Dave, good point. Excellent point. And that's frankly something I think we should do something about. JD in Brown County, Indiana, on Sirius XM. Hey, JD, what's up?
Hello, Tom. My intelligentsia guru dude.
Okay. What's up?
Listening to you for many years. I want to remind you the Secretary of State in Indiana, Charlie White, Republican, was convicted of voter fraud.
That's right. And but his voter fraud wasn't for political purposes. It was because he wanted to keep drawing a salary as a city clerk or something, and he had moved out of that city, right?
Yes, he was in a different – he used an incorrect address to vote. However, he did have – a valid driver's license. So he still committed voter fraud with a voter ID.
Right. And
so
this is a guy.
Voter IDs, they're moot.
Yeah. And they threw the book at this guy. 6 felonies?
Yeah. Well, he had much more on his plate, apparently.
Yeah. Apparently he was a fairly corrupt politician.
He's one of their man Mitch's guys, you know.
Mitch who?
Mitch Daniels.
Oh, Mitch Daniels. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. One of those little fascists that we've installed throughout the United States.
Surprise.
Yeah. Also, please, your listeners, those who have committed felonies and have paid their dues can vote. There's a line of bull that's been going around that people with felonies cannot vote, but in Indiana, you can vote.
In Indiana, you can.
Unless you are incarcerated. You,
right. It depends on the state. It depends on the state. In the state of Texas, you can't vote if you've ever been incarcerated in the, for a felony. In the state of Florida, the same. And I think it's wrong. I think if you've paid your dues to society, you should get your vote back. Thanks, J.D., for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, more ear calls. Plus, we're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service right after this. Occupying the airwaves, Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service. The Talk Radio News is brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And where in the world is Ellen Ratner? The last time we talked to you, you were in Antarctica.
Well, I am back from Antarctica and back right into the belly of the beast.
Oh, you're here in D.C.?
No, I'm in the New York beast.
Oh, that
I'll
beast.
I'll be in D.C. tomorrow.
You're in the lesser beast.
I'm in the lesser. Well, it depends on which beast you're looking at.
Yeah, okay, so what's going on today?
Well, what's really interesting is the Federal Reserve today came out with their Open Market Committee report. Mm-hmm. It pushed the stock market up. Basically, they said some interesting things. They said the economy was expanding moderately, that labor conditions continued to improve, that unemployment declined, and the word they used was notably.
Hmm.
And that they said the housing sector remains depressed and that inflation remains subdued, but crude prices are, of course, going up. And that they want everyone, it was a 9-1 vote where they said that they're going to keep interest rates for these are rates that banks loan overnight, et cetera, right, to a target rate of 0-1.25%.
Wow. Now, and that's what caused the market to rise, that last
part. Right. That's right. And they expect the low levels to remain there in terms of what they're going to do through 2014.
There was a fascinating chart, Ellen. I think you'd really the wonk in you would find this fascinating over at Talking Points Memo, TPM today, showing that during the first 3.5 years of the Reagan administration, you know, at this point in the Reagan administration, the Congress had voted to increase government spending by 12% over when Reagan was elected, which helped get us out of that great recession that, you know, Reagan, when he cut taxes on the ultra rich in 82, it threw the country into a tailspin. Unemployment went up to 11%, recession full blown, you know, full bore. But by the time he was running for reelection in 84, unemployment had gone down. Why? Because government spending had gone up 12%. The Republicans have so obstructed any attempt to do the same by the Obama administration that government spending, federal spending right now is exactly where it was when Obama came into office. It's 0%.
Right.
And,
yeah,
and this in spite of that, right?
And it is interesting, actually. Today there were quite a bit of goings-on in the Pentagon. They're now actually saying along those lines that they're actually going to decrease this.
That's right.
Spending, 5.5% reduction in military strength in the next 5 years. They actually, by 2015, expect to close 23 sites in Europe.
Wow. Well, you know, I salute that. I think, you know, the Pentagon budget, our military budget has tripled since 1997, and that's insane. On the other hand, the Republicans will go along with these cuts because they know that anytime you cut government spending, you slow economic activity slightly, and they want a bad economy in November.
Well, they certainly do. And, of course, don't forget, today we have two southern primaries, right, both in Mississippi and Alabama. Actually, the Alabama governor decided to vote for Santorum, but he's not endorsing him.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, what I found fascinating was that the plurality of Republican primary voters in Alabama and Mississippi believe that Obama is a Muslim, and only 16% believe he's a Christian.
I know. I saw that. I was reading that yesterday on my way back to the United States. Almost fell out of my chair.
Yeah. That's amazing.
So, some other interesting things going on. The president today actually spoke about what was going on with Afghanistan. He said he told President Karzai that the U.S. takes this as seriously as if it was our own citizens. Meanwhile, there was a funeral today for these 16 Afghanis, and there was there were two of President Karzai's brothers were there. A soldier that was guarding them was actually killed, and I believe two other Afghan soldiers were injured supposedly by the Taliban.
Hmm. Now, what about the reports that this was actually three guys and they were drunk?
You know, so far they're fingering one person, but again, the president did say today that he is ordering a full investigation. So, you know, again, this is allegedly things, and I think we just don't know yet. The president did, though, say that we have a strategy that will allow us to responsibly wind down this war. He said he wants to remove 23,000 troops by the end of the summer. And then, actually, today, Leon Panetta was on his way to Kyrgyzstan, and he said that there are strategic objectives that have not changed and will not change in terms of what happened with the massacre of the 16 people. He said war is hell, and these kinds of things take place, unfortunately, in war.
He's right about that, but what's the justification for the war? What are the strategic imperatives?
Yeah, well, he didn't say that, and nobody asked him.
Oh, jeez.
But he said that we are going to push on and bring this war to a responsible end, whatever that means.
Yeah, just like we did in Vietnam.
Now, also, right, yes. Today, the president, at the same time he made the statement, made a statement about trade. He said that the United States is initiating an action at the World Trade Organization about rare earth metals and rare earth minerals that he said constitute unfair trade practice by the Chinese trying to hold on to them. And
they have over 90% of the world market in this stuff.
That's right. And he said, just like we did with their tires, because I guess they were trying to dump tires, which means putting tires at actually below the cost that it cost them. He said, would they have been joined by Japan and some other European countries? Now, Chuck Schumer of New York said he wants this to be faster. And he said it's too long to go through the World Trade Organization, and he urged the World Bank to block any financing of Chinese mining projects.
That's interesting. Now, on the flip side of this is that we used to have rare earth mines in California, and they've been closed over the last decade or so because China was providing them to the world so cheaply. So, and
now they're holding on to them.
Yeah, these rare earths are, for people who don't know what we're talking about, these are the very obscure minerals, you know, lithium and molybdenum and tellurium or whatever. I don't know. I don't know what they all are. But in any case, these minerals that you've never heard of that are necessary to make computer chips and cell phones and things. And
particularly the things that you can actually touch screens. That's one of the biggest ones.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Okay. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st, by Ellen and Ann Gaiman. Ellen, thank you.
Thank you.
Great having you on. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And by the way, join Progressive Democrats of America, PDA, at their monthly brown bag lunch vigils. They call them BBLVs. They're coming up at your local congressional offices to show your support for health care, not warfare. To participate in a BBLV near you, or for more information, you can click on pdamerica.org, Progressive Democrats of America. That is not a paid announcement, by the way. I support the group. I think that they're absolutely spectacular, and there's some amazing work. Upton Sinclair, in 1906, wrote a novel about a dozen Lithuanian families who came to the United States to live in Chicago. They immigrated to Chicago and got jobs in meatpacking plants in Chicago. It was, I think Sinclair really wanted to write a book about how tough it was to be an immigrant. But what everybody remembers about his 1906 book, The Jungle, is the horrible, god-awful, creepy conditions in these meatpacking plants, and how could I ever eat anything that came out of that? That sparked a revolution in America, which brought about the creation of a whole variety of federal agencies that check our food or require the checking of our food, and state agencies as well. And now they're under attack. The Ayn Rand libertarian Republican thinking machine is out there saying, hey, just let commerce and industry do their thing and everything will be fine. As it was in 1906, right? We just want to go back to 1906. Stan Painter is on the line with us. He's the chairman of the AFGE, National Joint Council for Food Inspection Locals. The American AFGE, I don't have that spelled out here, Stan. I'm sorry.
Yes, American Federation of Government Employees.
Oh, okay. Of course. My apologies. So the AFGE is protesting some Food Safety and Inspection Services, the FSIS, changes that are coming up on January 27th. Well, actually, they already happened if it was January 27th. Tell me about this.
Yes, what the agency has proposed is it's a proposed rule that's in the Federal Register right now for public comments, and will be in the Federal Register until April the 26th of 2012. This is a process by which the agency plans to turn over organoleptic meat, poultry inspection to plant workers.
Mm-hmm. And so instead of having federal food safety inspectors, the number that I saw was something like, you're going from inspecting 91 chickens a minute to inspecting 175 chickens a minute. I don't see how you could I'd have a hard time inspecting 12 chickens a minute.
Well, you know, currently the standards are no more than 35 per inspector. You know, you do mm-hmm. have a line that's currently 91 in chickens.
Okay, so that's three inspectors.
Correct. With three inspectors, you're absolutely correct, and that's actually, you know, about 30 and a third. But the process that the agency standard that has been set, you know, over the years has been no more than 35 a minute, and now we're going from 35 a minute to 175 a minute.
That's amazing. It's also horrible. What is promoting this? What is prompting this?
Well, this thing has actually been in a pilot project since 1999. And, you know, supposedly this is a cost-saving measure that's supposed to save the agency $12-13 million, somewhere along those lines the first year, and allows the plant to make more money. The Federal Register proposal speaks to, you know, how much, you know, it will save the plants. But, you know, I'm wondering if this is a process by which that, you know, an ounce of prevention would be worth more than a pound of cure.
Now, you're the chairman of the National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals for AFGE. Do you think that this is, you know, much like we're seeing these attacks in the post office that in my mind are just pretty much nakedly union attempts to destroy the nation's largest unionized employer, the Postal Service, is this an attempt to take out unionized government employees?
You know, I actually believe that is the case. You know, we've been targeted for a period of time now, you know, as unionized employees. And, you know, I think this is something that we perform a valuable service for the consumer. You know, it's not like saying it's a bad habit. I'm going to break that bad habit. We can't eat. And we want to know that the poultry products that we eat on a daily basis are safe.
Do you have... I'm assuming that this is largely a partisan issue, that the Republicans are saying, yeah, get rid of those government employees, get rid of those inspectors, let the corporations check their own chickens, and the Democrats are saying, hey, wait a minute, we read Upton Sinclair's book.
You know, the only support that we've had thus far has come from Democrats, you know, calling for, you know, GAO audits. The last GAO audit was in approximately 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats are saying, you know, put the brakes on this thing. Let GAO do another audit. And Republicans are saying federal employees get rid of them all, pretty much. But certainly they don't want to clean around their own doorstep.
Right. Right. Remarkable. And finally, Stan, we're talking with Stan Painter, the chairman of the American Federation of Government Employees, National Joint Council of Food Inspection Locals, AFGE.org, the website. Finally, Stan, what can our listeners and viewers do to support you and your efforts?
You need to write your congressman. You need to email your congressman. You need to call your congressman. You need to there needs to be a public outcry. That, you know, I don't think that the consuming public wants to know that the plant that produces the product is inspecting its own product. You know, certainly comment on the Federal Register notice that's currently on the docket, and voice your comments and voice your concerns.
Great, and call your Congress, your member of Congress, and your two senators, and let them know how you think.
Well, without a doubt, that's something that we need to do without question.
Stan, thank you so much for the great work that you're doing and that AFGE is doing. And my apologies for the brain fart there. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks. Stan Painter, the American Federation of Government Employees, and AFGE.org, the website. You can check it out. Clifford in Ishpeming, Michigan. Hey, Clifford, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
So I have I'd like to know what your take is on this. With the BP thing, it was on the news where they, $100 million, $200 million fine or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, it was actually on the order of $20 billion, I think. But in any case.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, whatever it is. I mean, here's what I see as a problem, and as a parallel. You know, I've got a job, I got a family, and if I go out and do something wrong, and I got to pay a big fine, my family suffers.
Right.
Well, when BP does this, or Exxon, when they've done that, I mean, who is actually paying the fine?
The corporation pays the fine, and it's chump change to them.
Well, yes, but I mean, we are paying it. This is part of, as far as I'm concerned,
as consumers of their products. Sure, sure.
Yeah. This could be in a case like this, but a disaster like that. No, I really think that the government should step in, take over, and no profits should be made for that company until everything is paid for.
Yeah.
And believe me, the stockholders of that company or any other company, once this is established, would make sure that we have somebody there that is morally responsible for what they do. This is a bit of a joke because we are paying this. I mean, record prices for gasoline.
We're also paying it with our taxes, with all the subsidies that the government gives to the oil industry and the gasoline industry. And we're paying for what are called the externalities. We're paying for the costs associated with it in the cancers that are caused by the burning of fossil fuels, the global warming and the destruction of communities from hurricanes and tornadoes and floods and things from the burning of fossil fuels. We pay for that. The oil companies don't pay for it. We pay to protect their shipping lanes with our military. We pay with our tax dollars. They don't pay for that.
It costs them nothing.
Yeah, you got it, Clifford. And we need politicians who will speak truth to power. And in this case, the power is the big oil corporations. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, would you eat test tube meat? Really? I can eat any kind of meat.
Have a banana, have a whole bunch. It doesn't matter what you have for lunch. Just eat it, eat it, eat it.
Maybe not. So sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know. And sometimes, as the Fire Sign Theater, which is in mourning about the loss of Phil Bergman right now, the Fire Sign Theater says, everything you know is wrong.
Know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Is everything you know about test tube meat? Imagine going to a local burger joint 100 years from now. The way you travel there might be different. You might use a jetpack or a flying car. The way you order might be different. Maybe you'll communicate on your computer or telepathically. But despite all these changes, you'd expect one thing to remain the same, right? The meat. Well, maybe not. If you think that nice juicy hamburger will still be made from cows at a slaughterhouse, then everything you know about the hamburger of the future is wrong. Joining me now is Dr. Mark Post, professor of physiology and the chairman of the Dutch Society of Physiology at Maastricht University in the Netherlands. Dr. Post, welcome.
Good evening.
And my apologies if I'm mangling the name of your university and city.
No, it's fine. It's perfectly pronounced.
Oh, good. Where's the beef? You want to make meat, but there's no cows involved?
Well, we take stem cells from cows, so we still need donor cows to provide the stem cells, but much less than if we just grow the meat inside of the cow and slaughter them. So we think we can reduce the livestock tremendously.
So that would reduce the greenhouse gas emissions associated with growing all the grain to feed the livestock and the grazing lands and the water that they consume and all that kind of thing? Is this an increase in efficiency to produce meat?
Well, that's the point. The cows are very inefficient in producing meat from their food, and so are pigs, by the way. And we think we can do a much better job in the lab. And if we do, then indeed we can reduce all the environmental effects of livestock keeping and also, of course, animal welfare and actually food security, because, you know, consumption is going to double in the next 30 years due to the growing population, but also upcoming economies. So right now we are not realizing it yet, but we are going to face a meat crisis, if you like.
Mm-hmm. So test tube meat sounds totally gross. What color is it?
Well, it's still sort of whitish right now. We think we can make it pink through natural methods because...
You mean adding blood to it?
Sorry?
You mean adding blood to it?
No. The pink color of meat comes from a protein called myoglobin, which is very similar to the hemoglobin in our blood, and that we can let the cells just make by themselves because that's what they typically do.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Have any vegetarians or vegans weighed in on whether or not they'd consider eating test tube meat?
Well, I think they come in different flavors, vegetarians. Vegans, probably not. They are probably too orthodox to even consider this because it's still an animal product.
Yeah, but no animal was injured or hurt in making it.
Right, that's true. So some vegetarians may consider start eating meat. But, you know, for the environmental impact, I would rather that vegetarians keep on eating vegetables because
stay
that's even better.
Yeah, there you go. You guys haven't acquired the rights to the name Soylent Green, have you?
No.
Oh. Okay.
We haven't.
That's reassuring. Dr. Mark Post from Maastricht University, Maastricht, M-A-A-S-T-R-I-C-H, university.nl is the website, the scientific director of CAIRM, the acting scientific director of the School for Cardiovascular Diseases and professor of physiology. Thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
Welcome.
Take care. Great speaking with you. Thank you. Remarkable. Want some meat? Yeah, John in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, thanks.
John, would you eat test tube meat?
Not knowingly.
Okay.
But I may have already. I don't know.
I'm with you. Okay.
And I'm really scared about this pink slime thing.
Yeah, that's actually pretty gross, that the cartilage that they used to only put into dog food, they're now grinding so fine that, you know, because you can't chew the stuff, they're grinding it so fine that it turns it into slime and they add it to hamburger, 70% of the hamburger in America. Yuck.
Well,
I'm glad I haven't eaten a hamburger since
1968.
Yeah, I know the movie.
Soylent Green,
yeah.
That's not where we want to be.
There you go. I don't think that was the name of the movie. That was just the name of the food, wasn't it? Or maybe it was the movie.
No, I think that was the name of the movie.
Okay. All right. But that's not what you called about. You called about the post office.
I actually called about the post office.
Okay. Go for it.
I was wondering, because the guy that called, one of your callers earlier had mentioned something about direct democracy and using the internet to vote, so everyone gets to just vote the way they want to vote, blah, blah, blah. But I agree with that to a certain extent. And I want to move that into something like the post office. I'm always thinking of ways to help out the post office.
Right.
And why doesn't the post office get into email? And I know you're going to catch a bunch of people saying, oh, I don't want the government knowing what I'm emailing.
Hey, I suggested this.
Don't email that stuff.
I suggested, I used to run forums on CompuServe back in the 80s, and along with Sue, who runs our chat room, and Nigel, who's our webmaster, it's how we met. We were all running forums on CompuServe, and I was talking back then and have been ever since about, because CompuServe, of course, offered the early emails accounts. This was CompuServe was before the internet.
I'm old enough.
Yeah, okay. This was pre-internet. This was in the 80s.
Yep.
And I was saying, as email starts becoming more and more popular, spam was becoming more and more popular. And I thought, the post office has the resources to set up something that could be a really good email service. And I would gladly pay, a penny for every email that I send. If everyone that came in, I arrived for free, just like with the post office right now. I pay a penny per email to send to know that A, it was secure. B, it would be a federal offense for anybody to open it, just like it is with the U.S. Postal Service mail. And C, that then I was getting no spam. And,
it's 43 cents cheaper than regular mail right now.
There you
go. And they can put advertisers on the email website.
There you go. And who's advocating for this? You know who's pushing for what you're proposing, John? Senator Bernie Sanders.
Who's that?
Senator Bernie Sanders.
Nice.
He is looking for ways that the post office can make a buck so that they can stay in business after this Republican assault of 2006. Thanks a lot for the call, John. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Okay, Doug in Humul, California, watching or listening on Cable Radio Network, wants to set me straight about voter ID. And we've got the good, the bad, and the ugly coming up. Stick around. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very cacestogenously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, the American public. Even though congressional Republicans are attacking President Obama over high gas prices, it appears the American public can see right through the lies. A new National Journal poll shows 66% of Americans believe rising gas prices are due either to manipulation of prices by large energy companies or tensions in the Middle East. Only 14% of Americans believe it is President Obama's fault. In fact, the same survey shows more Americans trust the president to make the right decisions to bring down gas prices than they trust Congress. While misinformation often has far too much influence in our democracy and society, it's nice to see that this time the American public is wised up. The bad. Representative Cliff Stearns. In a meeting with constituents late last month, Stearns told the audience that America needs to sell off its national parks. Despite Republicans Stearns' call for a sell-off of the national parks, the fact is that national parks generate a significant amount of wealth for both the federal treasury and for local businesses, not to mention that they also generate a large number of jobs. America's national parks represent our nation's history, and if Stern wants to help improve our economy, maybe he should stop things like big oil subsidies instead. And the very, very ugly Uber lobbyist Grubber Norquist. In an interview on The Daily Show last night, Jon Stewart asked multimillionaire and K Street lobbyist Grubber Norquist if President Reagan should be scorned for raising taxes during his presidency. Norquist replied, "It wasn't on purpose. Reagan didn't want to raise taxes." Stewart then asked Norquist if he would have run somebody against Reagan, to which Norquist replied, "No, he hadn't signed the pledge." So while Norquist wants to impeach President Obama for raising taxes, President Reagan, and by the way, President Obama actually lowered taxes on working Americans, President Reagan gets a free pass just because he didn't sign Norquist's ridiculous pledge. Forcing lawmakers to respect the pledge before the Constitution, now that's just very, very ugly. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Doug in Humul, California, listening to us on Cable Radio Network. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, voter suppression.
Yes, sir.
So are you still adhering to that voter ID laws or voter suppression?
As I said to the last caller on this topic who was taking your position that voter ID was necessary and important, if you can name for me one person who was arrested and prosecuted in the last 20 years for politically motivated voter fraud, I will send you our book today that we're going to give to the person who does the very best post on our blog over TomHartman.com. Instead of that person, you will win it, Doug, a copy, a hardcover copy, collectible, autographed by me, of my book, Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. Got a name for me?
Well, guess what? That doesn't answer my question. That's nice. But
name one person who committed this crime that Republicans are passing laws against all over the country.
That's a gotcha question.
It's not a gotcha question. I guarantee you that when Willie Horton, got out of prison on work release and murdered a murderer and murdered a woman, The state of Massachusetts changed their laws and said, you know, there's a crime going on here and we need to do something about this. If you can name for me one person who was convicted of politically motivated voter fraud, I'll send you the book.
Well, I can do. I got a whole list of them.
I guarantee you, if there was one, Fox News would have made that person as famous as Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
Wait, are you telling me that there's no voter fraud? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I'm saying there's no politically motivated voter fraud. Who in their right mind would want to risk going to prison? Doug, let me ask you this question. It's a serious question. Who in their right mind would want to risk going to prison for a couple of years in order to cast one vote out of hundreds of millions for a candidate? Who would do that?
That's a good question.
Nobody would do that.
It sounds like you got that from the Brennan Law Center, because I'm reading it right here.
I just pulled that out of my brain, Doug. It makes common sense.
It's right on the Brennan Law Center.
Well, I'm glad the great minds think alike.
But the fact is that voter suppression is not legally, photo ID laws and proof of citizenship requirements are not voter suppression. The courts have already ruled that they're not. You can have a personal opinion that they are, but they're not. In Gonzalez versus Arizona,
Doug, for over 100 years, the courts ruled that.
The courts ruled that the 24th Amendment and the 14th Amendment were not violated by Arizona's proof of citizenship requirements. They voted against it. For the only fact,
and that makes it right.
In 1993,
Doug, stop. Hold. Take a breath for a second. Does that make it right? There is no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. The founders really struggled with this thing, and when the Southern states said we want you to count our African American slaves in the census so that we will have representation in the House of Representatives, we'll have more representatives from each state, but we don't want them to vote. The people in the North said, well, we allow African Americans to vote. And in fact, in some states, even women were allowed to vote. And they said, you know, we allow them to vote. So we're not going to let you count them unless you let them vote. And the Southern states said, then we won't join the Union. And so the outcome of that was the compromise, which had two pieces to it, which you can read in the Constitution. And some of this has been amended out of it, but it's in the first draft of the Constitution. You can read it in the current Constitution. Number one, that they would count 3/5 of the African Americans in the South as if they were persons for the purposes of determining how many congressional seats the Southern states would get. And number two, by the year 1808, trafficking in slavery would end in the United States. And the assumption was then all of those people would get to vote and they would all be counted and the 3/5 rule would go away. It didn't quite work out that way. It took the Civil War. But because of that conflict, the founders never wrote into the Constitution that everybody in this country has an affirmative right to vote, because it would have opened the whole can of worms of slavery. Because, you know, so we've got this original sin of slavery that we're all having to deal with, Doug. Does that mean that when the court looks at the Constitution and says there's no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution, that it's a right thing?
Of course not, but that's not what I'm saying. When the court ruled that the 24th Amendment, that voter ID laws and proof of citizenship does not violate the 24th Amendment or the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. They ruled that in Harper versus the Virginia State Board of Elections.
I know that.
And in Crawford. They both ruled it. The fact is,
that doesn't make it right.
Voter ID laws, might not make it right in your opinion.
That doesn't make voter ID laws right. Voter ID laws are laws. I mean, you know, you can pass laws. You know, there are laws against, walking on the street on Sundays in some states. The old blue laws, right? There's laws against letting your horse fart in public. I'm not making this up. There's a whole app on the my iPhone called Weird Laws. It's got like 26,000 of them. Some of them are absolutely hysterical. You know, it's illegal to paint flowers in some city, someplace. I mean, just all kinds of weird stuff. None of these are unconstitutional. They're just stupid. And voter ID laws may not be unconstitutional, but they're stupid. And they're not just stupid. They keep people from voting. They make it harder for people to vote. And that's what Republicans want. And they've been saying that for 30 years.
Not true. There's no evidence to keep them from voting. Let me tell you, we got a constitutional right to drink alcohol and own guns, but nobody can walk into a store and just sign a piece of paper and get a gun and get their booze and walk out the door. But that's exactly
actually you can.
You
can in Vermont.
Oh, well, good. One state?
I used to live in Vermont. You can walk in, buy a gun, stick it in your belt, or conceal it on your person, and walk anywhere you pretty much anywhere you want. They're
so you're gonna make
the least restrictive state in the union.
The one state is an exception. The fact is,
well, there's a whole spectrum of restrictions, but what does this have to do with gun laws? We're talking about the right to vote. I think that the right to vote, you know, it should have been in the Constitution, and if it wasn't for slavery, would have been in the Constitution. But they just couldn't, you know, it was just a bridge too far for those guys when half of them were slave owners. And you know,
in the Constitution,
that doesn't mean that we should have to live with Republicans who basically, you know, want to say, you know, we're going to exploit this and say, you know, no, if you're poor, you can't vote. If you're African American, you can't vote. If you're old, you can't vote. If you live in an urban area, you can't vote. I mean, that's the essence of what these laws do. And you know it as well as I do, Doug. Doug, why would you want a voter ID law if nobody is committing voter fraud? You can't name one person. I just offered you a book that probably on Amazon would sell for $25. You know, an autographed first edition hardcover that's out of print now. I mean, the hardcover is. The book's out in paperback now. And, you know, for $25, you can't come up with one name of a person who committed this crime.
Wait a second. I can commit. I got a whole list of them. I can't just reach it right now because I told you, you said it's a gotcha question. But
for political purposes.
The state of Minnesota found 123 cases out of over 2,000 that the Minnesota majority brought to them. They only would prosecute 123 cases. Why? Because voter fraud is determined by
because of evidence laws. Because of evidence laws, Doug.
The prosecutions determine what is or what is not voter fraud.
Okay.
And so,
Doug, respectfully, you are hysterical about a problem that doesn't exist.
That's not true.
Doug, do you really think out of millions, you know, 20, 30 million votes cast in a state the size of Minnesota, or 10 or 15, whatever it is, out of those millions and millions of votes cast, that 123 votes is going to swing an election? Are you really worried? Does that wake you up at night?
Wait a sec, you didn't hear what I said.
Aren't you concerned about the fact that you're voting on a machine that you have no idea if it's actually accurately reporting your vote?
123 vote is all they found. There was over 2,000 cases. They did not want to swing the election. No case in United States modern history has been overturned by non-citizen voting. They will not check and will not look into looking into it. No way to do it.
So it's the sneaky immigrants that you're worried about. They want to mess with our elections. I think they just want a job. Doug, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to Cable Radio Network. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We have the most interesting callers on this show. More right after this.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Jan E., by the way, gets a copy of my book, Screwed. In fact, the hardcover, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, autographed by me. For posting on our daily blog today about food prices. She says, yes, speculation on food prices and the commodities market that reaps the rewards large companies for pushing the market around for no reason other than gain. You can drive less, but most people can't eat less, and companies know it. So, Jan, thank you very much for that. John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Well, yeah, in respect to voter ID, I'm here in Minnesota, and I have not heard of these cases of fraud. And in fact, the University of Minnesota, I think, has researched this over many years, and it's like 0.1%. And
it's 0.0000502%.
Yeah,
nationally.
It's just really, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Right.
And that's the way I feel about the issue. But I wanted to ask you a question. The NAACP has gone to the United Nations Human Rights Council, and I would think that they wouldn't do that unless they really looked at this issue as inherently racist and going to affect, you know, African American people and people of color in a very significant way. That they felt that this is, I think, the first time since Jim Crow that the NAACP has gone to the United Nations expressing, you know, concern about what is going on in this country that is violating human rights. Yeah. And I think this is a human rights issue.
It is. Disproportionately, the number of people who don't have driver's licenses or government-issued photo ID are African-Americans who live in urban areas and don't need a driver's license to get on the bus and go to work, and Hispanics. And I'm not talking about illegal immigrants, in quotes, to Doug and Hamul, don't get hysterical. I'm talking about, you know, second, third, fourth generation, whatever, but people who are Hispanic and are also poor and also don't have driver's licenses, can't afford a vehicle. And those two groups are the highest probability of not having a driver, and the elderly, people over 70, less likely to have a driver's license. And, of course, they're very concerned about Medicare and Social Security, which the Republicans are trying to privatize. So, of course, the Republicans don't want them voting.
And also, there are a certain amount of people that lose their driver's license, and they may lose it on Election Day, enough people to sway an election. We've had some very, very close elections here. Al Franken was one of them.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just unnecessary. And so, you know, it's really up to their side to really produce the evidence that this is a real issue. And frankly, I don't think it is. I think it's very politically motivated, and also I think there's an undercurrent of racism in it, in this issue.
Yeah.
And that's all I wanted to say.
Okay, thank you. I'm with you, John. I appreciate the call. And thank you very much. Donald in Aurora, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Donald, what's up?
Yes, hi. You know what really gets me is the fact that last time I voted for her and I voted for Obama, I was required to have a voter's registration card. Well, that doesn't that mean anything anymore? Well, nevertheless, they asked me for my driver's license, too, and they checked both of them. So I don't know where this guy is coming off. But if I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, when during the last two Bush runnings for office, there was voter fraud going on Florida on the Republican side. Weren't they manipulating the machines or something to that effect?
No, there's speculation about that, but the actually mostly in Ohio. But first of all, there's a difference between voter fraud and election fraud. And election fraud is documentable and massive in the United States. In Florida, for example, and this is not in dispute, Catherine Harris, had a Texas database company. She paid them an awful lot of money from the state of Texas, had them pull a list of felons in the state of Texas, compare it with a list of voters in the state of Florida. The felons in Texas were disproportionately African-American. African-American names, in many cases, these are names that came out of slavery. There's the spectrum of last names is not as broad as it is for Caucasian Americans. And said any person in the state of Florida who has a similar name, so if it was James D. Johnson in Texas and it was Jimmy Johnson in Florida, it didn't matter. That person was the same person in Catherine Harris's mind, and they got knocked off the voting rolls. And over 70 or 80,000, they're still disputing whether it's 70, 80, 90,000, largely African-American voters in Florida showed up to vote on Election Day in 2000 and were told, sorry, you can't vote here. And this is the state that Al Gore won by only a few hundred votes when the recount was finally done after the Supreme Court, you know, a year later. And that George Bush theoretically won by only 500 votes. So that's election fraud. That's not voter fraud. That's a different thing. So
I wonder what they're doing about election fraud.
Nothing. They're committing it.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot, Donald, for the call. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk. Steve, listening on KPOJ in Portland. We got a minute to the break, Steve, or the end of the show, actually. It's all yours.
All right. We're talking about gas prices and how the cost of gas is not directly proportional to the raise in the cost of oil. There's more to the cost of gasoline than just the raw materials. There's the cost of refining it, the equipment. It's still costing the same amount to do a $100 barrel of oil as it does a $200 barrel of oil.
Sure.
That cost of refining it is the same. And then the taxes on gasoline it's a fixed tax on gasoline.
Plus you've got the cost of additives. Which have changed over the years with regard, you know, with changes in regulations.
Yeah, and I'm sure over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, they've gotten more efficient at their refining processes, too.
Sure, sure.
But the big thing is the taxes on gasoline are per gallon, not by, it's not
percentage.
A sales tax. A
right.
Percentage.
And it should be a percentage. And that's a horrible mistake that they made back in the 50s, or I believe it was, when they first passed the gas tax. Steve, thank you very much for the call. What is it with Republicans wanting to dump Social Security every 5 minutes? They have a better idea? I don't think so. Not even close. I'll confront Peter Ferrara, who's authored the latest conservative plan to so-called fix Social Security insurance. Coming up tomorrow. Plus, the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.